Welcome to CASBO Connect, the voice of school business. I'm Eric Dill, a member of the CASBO Legislative Committee.
And I'm Tina Douglas, vice president of CASBO. This episode, we're going to be talking about declining enrollment. So many districts have not fully rebounded from their pre-pandemic enrollment levels, and demographic projections are less than reliable than previous years for many reasons. More time is needed to determine statewide population shifts, new outflow, and the return of students to public schools. It's also unknown how many parents will withdraw their children from school in 22-23 when COVID-19 vaccinations are expanded to more age ranges and required for enrollment.
We have three guests on this episode that will share some of their thoughts on demographics, current funding models, and potential solutions. We'll also have a call to action for our local legislators at the end of the episode. So let me introduce our guests. First, we have Dr. Candy Clark. She's Associate Superintendent of Business Services at the Alameda County Office of Education. Welcome, Candy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we have Jennifer Stahlhebert, Chief Financial Officer of San Juan Unified School District. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we have Tony Wold, former Associate Superintendent of Business Services for West Contra Costa Unified School District. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you for having me here.
Great. Okay. So let's start off by taking a look at our demographics. As we had said, a lot has changed with enrollment. Let's start with Jennifer first. How much of your enrollment have you recovered from pre-pandemic? I know we're still in the pandemic, but before then, what has your enrollment looked like since then?
Well, we had been experiencing some declining enrollment. And since 2015-16, we've had an overall decline of 1,776 students. But since the pandemic has started in 1920, we've seen a decline of 1,236. So for that total decline that we've seen since 2015-16, 70% of it's come during the pandemic. And so we aren't necessarily seeing a recovery yet. We think we're still experiencing some decline due to the pandemic and some of the related mandates, but we are looking closely at, you know, what's triggering it. How can we help our families feel safe with returning to school, or how can we help those that maybe don't want to abide by the mandates, but how can we still deliver a high level of instruction for them and their students?
Tony, what about you?
So we saw in the East Bay a decline right at the beginning of the pandemic of about 800 of our 29,000. But then this year we saw even greater, another 1,200. And when we talked to our neighbors in the East Bay and some of the other large urbans, we're seeing the exact same trend, that you had a doubling of the reductions from the first year, 2021, to this year, making it even more significant.
And Candy, you're a county office CBO. So first, how many districts are in Alameda County?
There are 18 school districts, 3 regional occupational programs, and 58 charters within the county.
And you've got some really large districts and some high profile districts in Alameda County. So 18 districts, but you know, a very large one in Oakland Unified, plus a number of other large districts as well.
That's correct.
Yeah. So what's the trend been in Alameda County with declining enrollment?
So pre-pandemic, we definitely saw districts that were declining. What has been interesting this year is that for many of our districts, they projected declines. However, they declined at a higher rate than what they originally anticipated. So you may have had a district that's thought, okay, we're going to decline by 200 students. And then that number actually ended up being 500 or 600 students. On average, we're seeing anywhere between a decline of about 3 to 5% on the higher end. As you look across the state, on average, it was around 3%. But there are some pockets within Alameda County that are seeing numbers, you know, higher than the trends across the state.
Yeah, and I was at Santa Clara County Office of Education during the pandemic, and we had 32 districts in that county, and all but one were experiencing decline during that time. So only one grew in the last school year. So, you know, this is definitely something that we're seeing statewide. I know in my current district, we dropped 800 kids. We've recovered about 400 of them. So, you know, only got about halfway back to where we were pre-pandemic. How about you, Tina?
Yeah, we have been leveling out. So our enrollment was kind of steady. We were anticipating a decrease this year of about 200, and we actually ended up with double that. So a decrease of about 4. So I think everyone is kind of in that same boat. We thought this was going to be a normal school year being open for in-person instruction, and it turned out to be less than normal and probably worse than what we all anticipated in that respect. And so knowing just some of those numbers that we've all talked about, the new question is now, how do you project enrollment for the upcoming school year? And how are we planning for the end of the ADA hold harmless? Knowing that what we've seen is we're projecting a decline, the decline has come in even more than what we all thought, knowing that there's going to be this new vaccination requirement, how do we even begin to figure out what that number is going to look like? Can you guys share maybe some of your scenarios and how you guys are planning for that? I'll start with Tony this time.
So initially, when we looked at it starting this year, knowing that we were coming back in person, we anticipated that some of the students that we had lost might be coming back. Those that delayed kindergarten because they didn't want to take it virtually would come back. And we ended up seeing a completely different trend. There was even a larger group that didn't return. And I think that the whole focus on projections is a way different model than we've ever done before. We don't have any statistical data that we can use. The last 2 years are completely thrown out because there's no connection. You can't go back to previous trends because a district like ours that has a lot of newcomers that normally come in as first-time education in California, the borders have been closed to an extent that we're not seeing that. So part of what we anticipate is it's going to be another month or two after you start to get normalization before you're going to start to see some of the old trends going. So part of our concern was everything we show is we're going to decline more next year. But there are a population of students that are not being served in public schools today. They're somewhere. They haven't all left California, and they are going to come back. And many districts are going to be stuck in a situation where they're making reductions based on projections that aren't relevant, and then having an influx of students. And with the labor shortage, it can be even more pronounced as a crisis piece. So that's part of the reason we're starting to talk now about needing to have some stability of planning from the business and HR lens.
Yeah, and we actually are starting our position control meetings. We just had our first one 2 weeks ago, and it may sound really early, but with the new March 15th deadline, knowing what our enrollment looks like, we're having discussions about how we might be able to leverage one-time dollars to potentially keep some of those teachers on, et cetera. Jennifer, what about you? How are you guys looking at enrollment scenarios right now?
Yeah, so we're seeing the same, you know, trends where we don't really have good trends because it's such an unusual year. And so we feel like, you know, to be conservative, we're using this year's numbers and data for our projections. But where we're seeing a bigger hit is less due to the decline and more due to the attendance rate. We have so many students, you know, we're encouraging them to stay home if they don't feel well, if they have any symptoms. We have, you know, different levels of quarantine that are required based on different circumstances. And so we're seeing a bigger decline and a bigger hit in our funding projections based on the attendance rate coming down. And so we're having a lot of conversations around that and what that means and what it looks like. And we've also had to increase our possible, you know, right-sizing and layoff process as well because of the new law around certificated hires. We started that process back on the 8th and sent out position control reports and are already having those meetings as well. So it's a very different year from a perspective of projections and budget. And where we typically would see P1 and expect a slight decline for P2, we don't know. Maybe it'll get better. Maybe, you know, people will feel safer as more and more folks are vaccinated, but we don't really know. It's really created an unusual year for us.
And Candy, just from your perspective at a county office level, you guys are the oversight agency. What are you going to be looking for in terms of school districts and what their projections are going to look like? What's a reasonableness test for you?
So let me start off by saying I agree with everything that Jennifer and Tony said. It is unbelievable the amount of volatility in the demographer reports. I mean, a lot of people are just putting the demographer reports to the side because they're just, they don't mean anything in this environment. One of the things that I have been working with our districts on and asking them to take a close look at is the kindergarten enrollment based on their prior projections. Because for the kindergarten students, I mean, if you start seeing significant drops, that's not necessarily something you're going to recover in 1 year. That bubble could potentially stay with you for the next 12 years. So that's really important. The other thing that we've been talking about within our county is, you know, did the kiddos just move from one district to another? And so countywide, you know, do we have a net loss? We did a survey in October and we actually determined that, no, there is truly a net loss. So the kids are not just moving from one district to another. I've heard that there have been increases in enrollment in our private and parochial schools, in our charter schools. And then on top of that, we are actually seeing families move out of the Bay Area. And so I've been talking to a lot of our districts, just trying to figure out what's happening, right? Is it more about the parents just keeping the younger kids at home? Are they, you know, going to more independent study? And what we've seen is that it's all over the map. There's not necessarily one rhyme or reason for why the kids are leaving. But at the end of the day, they're not necessarily showing up. We're also seeing in our county situations where, you know, like I said earlier, the district projected a decline. There was a further decline. And even now there's still remnants of additional declines within the system. So I'm not sure we're at a place to where we've even flatlined to get to the point of saying, okay, this is a potential baseline. The other thing that I'm concerned about is parents that have chosen to utilize independent study. If we ever get to the point to where children are required to come back to school, I wonder how many children will actually show up. There have been some instances where we've heard that students may actually be attending schools in California, but maybe residing outside of the state. And so I don't know if that's going to be a big anomaly or if it's just, you know, maybe a one-off here or there in the county, but it's something that I also think we should keep a pulse on. The position control as it relates to staffing is significant. So how do you project your staffing pieces in terms of, you know, how many kids do you need? How many kids do you need in a class and how that relates to, you know, what's actually happening with staffing? That's a problem because, if you don't understand where your student enrollment is, how can you project the staffing?
Well, and I don't know about you guys, but we have quite a few maternity leaves coming up, but those COVID babies are not going to help us for another 5 years.
Well, we're going to get into some of your thoughts and ideas later about the hold harmless. But, you know, one of the things Jennifer mentioned earlier triggered me because she's talking about the drop in average daily attendance. The enrollment, we know what it is, but our ADA is lower as a percentage than it has been historically. And I know one of the ideas that's floating out there is, why don't we do with the LCFF what we do with the unduplicated count and make it a 3-year rolling average? Well, that might be a good idea if we had a stable trend. But if this current school year gets factored into that 3-year average, I think you're still going to see a precipitous drop across the state. And to some of the points that Candy was making about the kids are kind of all over the place. You know, a year ago, Tina and I did an episode that was all about the drop in the unduplicated count. We were talking with districts that were worried about that, and we still weren't quite certain where everybody was. And you know, one of the things that we said in the episode is, hey, if all of these students that we can't find right now, and this was a year ago, are popping up somewhere else in the state, well, that's fine. That's what the local control funding formula does. It follows the students. But if they're disappearing in a school district, they're disappearing from the county, and they're not showing up anywhere else, that's a statewide problem. And you know, I know school services had a fiscal report recently that showed the statewide trend. And I think every county, except for one, was orange or red in terms of its decline, and only one was a positive, and it was less than a percent. And so the one county was treading water, but every other county seems to be losing. I know the state will have more data as they look at our census data, but this is certainly something that the legislature and the governor are going to want to take a close look at as they're preparing the budget for next year. So let's go back to Candy, and we'll talk about funding for a moment. I know that county CBOs meet once a month, along with state officials from the CDE and the Department of Finance, also with FICMAT. And there's been a concern that all of the one-time and categorical funding that we've received in the last 2 years is covering up structural deficits. Do you and your colleagues see a real danger to districts when the one-time funding runs out, and at the same time that we might revert back to collecting on actual attendance?
I think it's a major problem. I think it's a cliff that's not necessarily being talked about enough. We had districts in our county that were already in fiscal distress pre-COVID and that needed to make millions and millions and millions of dollars in reductions, right? Some of those districts were already struggling to come to grips with the need to develop budget balancing solutions for those districts. Flash forward to a COVID environment where we've had this huge influx of money. Those same districts that were in fiscal distress are now, in some instances, 100% reliant on one-time dollars to remain fiscally solvent. And so our county took the perspective of looking deeper at those districts in those particular situations and attempted to pull the layers off. Like, what happens when you take the one-time dollars away? What does your fiscal condition look like? I mean, it was not a pretty picture for several of our districts. We took a very proactive approach in terms of calling out those scenarios and requiring those districts to continue to talk about budget balancing solutions that are necessary. I realize that may not be the most popular thing, but it's the most appropriate thing to do. In a perfect situation, you'd be able to incrementally step the district's budget down to balance. But when you have a district that was already, like I said, dealing with, millions of dollars in deficits pre-COVID, and now they've continued to decline in enrollment, and you continue to see certain expenses go up, it makes it very difficult to come to a place of reasonableness in terms of whether or not that district will be able to remain fiscally solvent. And so I'm very concerned about that. And I know I have colleagues around the state that are in the same situation.
Yeah. And so we rely on this wise advice and oversight from our county CBOs. But you only have so much power. You have the oversight responsibility, and you can point out, comment, direct, and advise districts. But ultimately, it's up to that local district to make the decisions to bring the expenditure budget in line with the revenue side. So following Dr. Clark's wise advice, Jennifer, luckily you're outside of her county, so she's not looking at your budget, but how do you educate your board and your colleagues and stakeholders about these dangers that we're talking about?
Well, I was fortunate that when I arrived in San Juan, they were, into their ELO plan. They had done a lot of engagement for the ESSER plan, and we had created plans that use the funds over 3 years. And so we know we have funds set aside for, next year, that, in that third year, and then those couple months going into 23-24, that we believe will help us kind of mitigate some of the reductions that we have to incur so that we can kind of ease into them. And we feel like that's really important right now because there's so many staffing shortages that at a time when we know our students have great needs and we're trying to fill all of these temporary positions, to then have to, issue layoffs and notices, that positions are being eliminated. We thought having this plan that's multi-year is going to help us get through that. And so where we would have made reductions, we may not have to because we'll be able to use some of those funds. And so we wrote it into the plan to be able to have that flexibility. And we're having those conversations now with the board, with our union groups about what that's going to look like and what fund balance is going to do as well to help mitigate some of those reductions that we would have otherwise incurred, you know, very quickly, kind of being able to spread those out over several years. It also, you know, the conversation around being in a test one and having reserve limits also helps us have that conversation, because I think before, where it was difficult to have folks commit fund balance in the past, I think now seeing the need to really have a plan for the future is going to help us have those conversations. So we're also starting to have those conversations so that we can maintain our staff, keep our qualified staff, not lose them to other districts, because we know everyone right now is in great need.
And Tony, you know, how do you talk to the stakeholders who want to believe that the money is always going to be there when it's not?
Well, I think that's been the biggest challenge that we've faced over the last couple of years, is the amount of needs have gone up exponentially, as have all of the demands and pressures. As Dr. Clark spoke, I was very much in an organization that was in a fiscal cliff prior to the pandemic. The same week that we shut down in March, we did over 400 layoffs. And then we utilized, just like Jennifer talked about, we utilized a lot of those one-time funds to restore and maintain positions, and had built a plan over the next couple of years to try to continue to move that pathway, with the hope that as the state got itself back on its own 2 feet, it would be able to provide just enough ongoing revenue to cover the last part of the structural deficit. But none of us planned what we're seeing now, with not just the enrollment declines of 5 to 6% that are going to hit in 1 year. Because remember, this is a 2-year decline that shows up immediately on the budget with no ladder or no change. But the ADA decline is another couple percent. For us, the ADA decline where I was leaving was more than 1,000 students there in change in funding. So when you start looking at the numbers, you're talking about every time you do 1,000, it's $10 million. And it keeps adding up across. And so what we're seeing is this perfect storm, because you also brought in the UDP, the unduplicate account. Last year, it was a lot easier for districts because there still was free and reduced lunch applications that we had sort of moved to the pandemic service, but families had a motivation. This year, all students receive a free meal. The same motivation isn't there. And we were finding that in many of the districts I talked to across the state, they were seeing 5 to 10% decreases in their unduplicate account this year because the deadline wasn't extended. There's not a motivation. Families are very difficult to locate. And so what you're going to have is a triple impact to a budget. When you start pulling out your multi-year projection, and you, especially if you are a concentration district, remember, for every unduplicated account over 55%, you're getting 65% of that base grant. That's going to quickly cripple the most needy districts in California. As we get to advocacy, we'll talk about there are ways to get there. And what I've been doing and will continue doing as I make my shift is tell the story of what we can do for kids today, because this is what has happened in the last 18 months is going to be 36 to 48 before we can stabilize. And if we don't recognize that, that we need to have a longer runway and period, we're not going to be able to really provide the services, because we still don't even have all the people. We were short 50 teachers and over 150 classified that aren't here. And so we're having to take all of our specialists and put them into classrooms, which means they're not doing their specialist work, which means curriculum development isn't in there. There's all these different components that layer on top of each other that are part of the story.
Yeah, we could do a whole episode on the additional, let's just call it categorical funding that we've received that we can't put to work right now because we simply do not have the staff to build those programs. And I was on one of those calls this morning when we were talking about the Expanded Learning Opportunities program and the before and after school funding that we've received. And you know, our provider just cannot find the people to do that. So that one's going to be a struggle for us. Maybe it'll be an episode down the line. You've given us flashbacks to, it might've been our second or third episode that we called The Cliff. And we were talking with the CBO of Gilroy Unified, who was facing losing his concentration grant funding because they didn't have the free and reduced numbers. And they literally were going door to door until they couldn't do that anymore under the public health order to try and establish those kids.
Tony, you mentioned the drop that people are potentially seeing in their unduplicated pupil count because there is no incentive to fill out, you know, any free and reduced price meal application. We made a push in our district this year with alternative income forms. It almost had a negative effect on us. It almost flipped us out of basic aid. We had an 8% increase in people that qualified from that alternative income push. So, I mean, different effects for different people. And you talked a lot about the effects. I'm going to start with Jennifer and come back to you, Tony, because you talked a lot about this already. What happens, Jennifer, in your district if we were to go back to an ADA attendance model next year without the hold harmless? Like, what does that look like for you in terms of numbers?
Yeah, we would take about a $13 million hit, and that's $2 million in our supplemental, you know, over $11 million in our base funding. And so we're already having conversations of what that'll look like in those out years. You know, what do we need to look at for our site allocations? Because there's a lot of work that our sites are doing that's very specific to their students' needs that come out of those supplemental funds. And so we know they're the ones that are going to be hit the hardest with this. And so we're having those conversations now, but we're also trying to find ways to help kind of do our own hold harmless if possible. So that's, again, going back to the conversation of if we have fund balance, maybe we can commit that to, you know, cover that loss in our supplemental funds, because we know those funds are really driving a lot of actions at our sites that are geared towards very specific needs. And so, you know, we're always trying to prioritize, you know, what's the best avenue to go down for our students. And really, our sites are the ones that know what that is. And so we're really focusing on how can we make sure our sites have the funds they need to make the decisions they need to make for their students. Yeah, it's very scary. I ran some numbers with the 3-year rolling average, and it actually kept us flat. And so even though we took this huge hit this year in our attendance rate, it did hold us flat. So, you know, I'm really hopeful that the legislature will come up with some type of solution that's going to help districts, because I know there are some districts out there that have taken a bigger hit in any one of those three categories or all of them combined, that they would not stay flat. And so I think we'll need more than just, you know, one of the options we're going to discuss here today. So I'm really looking forward to see the advocacy that CASBA does on our behalf, because they always do a great job.
And you mentioned about committing funds in order to help with some of those programs. I think that's going to be another challenge that school districts are going to have, where we've tried to identify ways to help our students with this one-time money that we're receiving. At some point, as we heard Candy talk about, most districts are deficit spending. And now when you start taking those layers away, those programs are going to have to go away too. And now our next battle is going to be with those families who have gotten used to those additional levels of support that we're no longer going to be able to sustain. So I appreciate the fact that you guys are having conversations around how do you commit some of those funds to help maintain some of those programs that have been put in place, because that's really going to be the next conversation that I hear us are probably going to be talking about. That's going to be our newest challenge. Tony, you talk a lot about some of this already. Do you want to share with us what some of your impact would be if we were to go back to funding on actual ADA?
Yeah, and actually, I'd like to kind of take a step backwards to come back to one district instead. When we started to look at our numbers, we reached out to some of the colleagues across the state and talked to 12 districts total that represent 15% of our state's enrollment. And those 12 districts, with their decline of over 5% in their enrollment, another 2% in ADA decline, we're talking about a $600 million price tag. If the law stays exactly as written, you're talking about districts across the state, big ones, Long Beach, San Francisco obviously has been in the papers, but then just go to Little Contra Costa County, just north of Candy. There, the five biggest districts crosses 100 million. Just Little Contra Costa County is going to have $100 million reduction right now based on the way situations go. Now, there's options towards doing it, and this is just one county. You can start adding county by county. That's going to be people's jobs. That's going to be a lot of anxiety and a lot of hard conversations for our stakeholders that right now are still just trying to get more resources for their students, and to instantly flip to a cut mode when we know the state is going to be talking about a COLA doesn't really make sense. And it puts us on a defensive as leaders. That's a very hard story to tell.
And Candy, I know that as a county office employee, you guys are always running your own analytics in terms of what the impact may be for school districts within your county. Have you guys actually run the numbers yourself to see what the actual ADA loss and impact would be within your county?
Yeah, and it varies from district to district. I think the biggest takeaway is for my county, I didn't see a situation where any of our districts would fare well, you know, do better than others. But, you know, I didn't have a situation where, gee whiz, if this happens, then, you know, this district is actually going to, you know, be balanced or sustainable. I mean, it's, again, getting back to that point of who's deficit spending and by what degree. I think the other thing that we haven't talked about here, but I'm going to bring it up, is districts that are qualified in this environment with all of these one-time funding sources. My concern is if we make that flip back over to, you know, the way that the ADA was working before, how many of those districts would actually be in a situation where they could potentially be negative? I mean, that's the concern. Because again, as everyone has said on this call, it is very hard to make those difficult decisions in terms of balancing a budget when there's so much one-time money. And I think that we all need to do our best to convey that a one-time funding source is not a viable solution to balance a district's budget, right? It may give us a runway so we can incrementally step it down, but it cannot be that those one-time funding sources are the long-term solution to a district's fiscal situation. And I've seen districts that have received, you know, almost double what their general fund was pre-COVID. I've seen them where it's a third of their budget. And so if we're going in and adding expenses, you know, utilizing those resources and then not making those difficult decisions to balance the district budget, I think it's a perfect storm to see more districts be in a situation of significant fiscal distress.
And it's going to be a difficult story to explain when the state is doing so well right now, beating all of its revenue projections. We've been flooded with lots of one-time money. And that's one thing, again, that we are very grateful to the legislature and the federal government for providing all of the resources to deal with the extraordinary expenses related to COVID. So we're all very grateful for this. But if the tap runs dry, people are not going to understand. They're going to say, you have all of this money. What did you do with it? So, you know, and as we talk about the level of fiscal distress that would happen if we reverted back to this ADA funding, and just to use Tony's number for one county, I know it's not in the state's interest to issue 1,000 state loans across the state when you look at the nearly 1,000 school districts that we have. So, you know, the legislature will have to address this in some way. It's just a matter of, will they do it in a way, you know, that really makes sense and, you know, provides what districts need on an ongoing basis and recognizes that this drop might be a complete rebenching of our statewide ADA that we need to then build upon from there. But let's go back to the unduplicated count again, because as we had the hold harmless for average daily attendance in the local control funding formula, we didn't have that same hold harmless for the unduplicated count. Our guests have talked about the unintended consequence of the great thing that the legislature did, which is provide universal free meals. I mean, everybody was really excited about continuing that, and it's a good thing for kids. But as you've all pointed out, there's now no incentive for families to fill out the application or even to voluntarily provide information on the alternative income form. They used to get something for giving us that information. Now they don't get something. So there really is no, you know, carrot to hold out to parents. We do get a number of students who qualify as low income from direct certification. So we know if they're receiving other services, they could qualify for that. But another unintended consequence of rising wages, you know, could be that families are now above that limit, and a lifetime of poverty is not going to be erased by a higher minimum wage or even, you know, somewhat higher than minimum wage in jobs that used to be historically low paying. You know, so that loss of supplemental and concentration grant funding, if that happens, you know, could have profound ripple effects across the state. Any thoughts on that, Jennifer?
Well, I think, you know, it's different for every district. You know, we had hit over the 55% and qualified for concentration in 1920. And then in 2021, when with our students not being in the classroom with the teachers and administrators, we took a big hit. We dropped to just under 51%. In our unduplicated pupil percentage. And so this year we actually saw it increase back up to 53.6 currently. And we think it was because our teachers, our administrators, they could talk to families, they could talk to the students and talk to them about the significance and the impact that, you know, we could endure because they didn't complete that information for us. And we think it's because we have those lines of communication and we've built, you know, strong relationships of trust with our families, that the in-person worked better for us. It didn't do well for us last year when we weren't in person. And so I think for some districts, that's going to make a big difference in what they see in those out years for those numbers. Now, granted, we would love to be back up above the 55%, and we're still doing a lot of work to talk to our families. But just even the 3% growth makes a huge impact for us when we look at projections out for funding.
And Tony, how about you?
And I think this is an area that we're going to probably need to make a complete revision in how we do business, because the reality is the need for meals was so proven in the pandemic that now that districts are getting that ramped up to actually have it served, that's probably going to be something that stays in the future, which means that we're always going to run into this. And those districts that were provisioned to already had these challenges where you didn't have to rebench for 4 years or 6 years. And we're already struggling because people didn't see the connection. And as you said, what is the wage level that addresses a lifetime of poverty? Because now you make $400 more than the poverty limit, you're completely solved and fixed. So I think that this is one of those things where we do need some form of basically a freeze on this and then take some time to create a completely new data collection methodology, because what we're doing is not working, where districts are having to struggle and push on each and every one of their parents to do income each and every year, and then have to do it over and over again, where it might make a lot more sense to look at who are your new students and who are your kindergartners and focus on them and maintain everyone else with their previous status unless there's some other prevailing event. I just think it's taking us away from our core function, which is service to students, towards being a data collection agency for the legislature that doesn't have a better way of figuring out the formula.
Well, we're all healthcare professionals now too, right? I mean,
and
so I just
health,
add this to the list.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit. We've already started the conversation just around some solutions and with some of the challenges that we have, but One of the other things that you had mentioned earlier, Tony, I believe, is that, you know, we're struggling to fill positions right now. That has been a thing that I think everyone, not only teachers, but classified staff, we just can't get people in there. So the good thing is that actually has provided some savings to the budget, right? Because the positions are vacant for a while, we're able to reduce that budget. But now we've got the new classified layoff provisions, which adds another, you know, problem to the mix, if you will, that we have to address, which is why, like, one of the reasons I said we're working on lists now. But how concerned are you with the changes to that provision and the impact that that's going to have? Jennifer, I'll start with you.
Well, it's making it really difficult because we have all of these open positions. You know, when I look at, I just ran a report to look at how many open positions we have. It's over 800. And some of them, you know, are just an additional 2 hours for, you know, an IA, various classified positions, but a lot are teaching staff, mental health professionals. And to know that we have this new process that makes us make decisions much sooner than we've had to in the past, before we have a really clear picture of what our, you know, budget's going to look like next year. We don't know what type of COLA we're going to receive. We don't know if they're going to make a change to the funding formula, but we know that we have this new process that we need to adhere to, or we could put ourselves in a position that we end up with a deficit because we didn't prepare. And so it's really challenging to have all of these open positions, to have all of the staffing need, and they have conversations about reductions and layoffs. And so it's been really hard for our administrators. You know, their focus is on students. And so when we're scheduling these meetings and telling them what it's about, they're like, what do you mean? I have 20 open positions currently. And you want me to look and see where I'm going to make reductions? Like, it doesn't make sense to them. And so it's been a lot of just conversations, telling the story, making sure they understand, you know, yeah, we have these one-time funds, and we're gonna try to fill them and meet students' needs based on what they are currently. But for our base funds, the things we've always done, we're gonna experience a reduction. And so we have to reduce in staff. And so it's very complex. It's changed the process, and I'm sure it's going to evolve over the next couple of years as we get used to this new normal.
Tony, what about you?
So I think this is the biggest elephant on the backs of administrators. Right now, if you're a chief business official and you're following the county's guidance, you're going to budget based on law. So you're going to come in and you're going to put in your multi-year projection using my former district, a $30 to $40 million reduction. That wipes out your reserves in 1 year. What do you do for year two if you don't have cuts? So now you're looking at having to either tee up a March 15th notice immediately right now when nobody even has it on their radar as a possibility, or wait an entire year and draw yourself down to zero with zero options available. What's going to happen is you're going to have anger. You're going to have frustration. You're going to have people that just got that layoff notice not coming back to the system already. We're already struggling to get people. They're working two jobs. They're working three jobs. They're working overtime. In fact, they won't take more overtime because they're so exhausted. And we're going to put our educators that have been trying to provide service through that. We're going to put our leaders through that. You're going to see, we saw a significant number of superintendents retire. We saw the same thing with chief business officials. And there's not a lot of us out there that are willing to take on the fight and the love of focusing on education. So I think right now, this is one place where the legislature needs to understand that if we don't have clear guidance, we're going to do what Dr. Clark says. We're going to create our multi-year projections based on law. Ideally, I think you need to do two. You need to do one with what should be and what is, so that your stakeholders understand why it's happening. It's not you, but there always needs to be somebody to blame. And that's part of our challenge, is how do you articulate the challenge as well, but also have solutions. And I know we'll talk about solutions in a minute, because I do have a couple ideas.
And I get to blame Eric because I replaced Eric. So I blame everything on him, even though he's been gone long enough, it's his fault.
Candy, it looked like you wanted to add to that.
I did. You know, I agree with the comments. It is very difficult to be in a situation where you've got these one-time pots of money and then in the same instance, you know, have to have these conversations around staffing and the possibility of reductions. I think that while there are one-time dollars that are available that can kind of, you know, help a district stabilize the budget, this really is the time to do that deep dive into those staffing ratios. Like, are you staffed to contract? Question number one, right? If you're declining in enrollment, where are you declining within the system? And are there opportunities to, and I hate to say it, move individuals within your system from one school to another, right? It's not popular, but if you're trying to really keep staff, these are the types of things that really need to be, you know, dug deep into. When it comes to programs and things that are happening at the school site, you know, is it a nice to have or is it a requirement? And if you can afford the requirements, great. If you can afford the nice to have things, that's awesome. But if you're declining in enrollment and you need to rebalance, you probably want to look at some of those pieces to figure out how your staffing is really aligned to your strategic plan for your students and how your academics, you know, are really aligned to that in order to make sure that you don't have, you know, essential positions that really are going unfilled. Like if I had to choose between a math teacher versus something extracurricular, in that difficult situation, I'm probably going to choose that math teacher, right? And so I think that as time goes on and we start looking at, you know, how we're going to have to tighten up some of these areas within staffing, that's going to be really important to have some of those critical conversations. I don't know how many districts do, you know, zero-based budgeting or a modified form of zero-based budgeting, but it really should be some opportunities to just unpackage what's happening within the system to make sure that you're funding your priorities first and staffing them appropriately. And then everything else is going to fall out the way it did.
Well, Candy, it's almost like you read my mind because I was going to ask the three of you, and I was going to start with you of what advice do you have for your colleagues? And you just gave it right there. So before I move on to Jennifer and Tony, is there any other advice that is on your mind that you would be giving the districts in your county and through this podcast, the state?
I do think it is very important for districts to look at the MYP with and without the one-time funding. I know that some districts went through that exercise, maybe even internally, but if you're looking at those two scenarios and you're seeing significant levels of fiscal distress, you're going to have to show that information and start engaging in that conversation, because the sooner you're able to do that, the more awareness you're able to drum up around the situation. I think that when we look at our AB 1200 process, it really is an early warning system. We have 3 years, current year plus two subsequent years. And so the one-time dollars are really camouflaged in certain situations, what's happening. You got to take the camouflage off and show what's really happening in the district. And those conversations are going to be difficult in many instances, because for the average person, they don't understand how you just got $20 million in one instance, but now you're talking about budget reductions. I think that if there ever was a time to do a budget roadshow, this is probably the time for some LEAs to go on the road within their community and really explain the true fiscal condition of the district and share the things that the district is doing in order to ensure that student achievement, if, as well as fiscal solvency, are top priorities. And last and certainly not least is I believe that there has to be some conversation at the state level about the hold harmless. I would definitely be one that would advocate for the hold harmless provision to be extended, only because of the volatility within our enrollment in ADA at this point. I mean, it's not like this is something districts are doing on purpose. It really is difficult to be able to pin down what the enrollment is going to be and how do you actually, you know, kind of fine tune what's happening with ADA right now. I think state intervention would be beneficial in that area.
Well, that's just great advice all around. And, you know, the good news is that every CBO out there has two versions of their MYP already. It's just a matter of who they're sharing it with. There's always a good news, bad news one. And there's also one that has extra years tacked onto it that they're not showing anybody else. So it's just a matter of following your advice and saying, okay, we need to have honest and conversations to set the stage of what those scenarios could be. So that's all great advice. Jennifer, do you have anything to add to Candy's advice?
Oh, I echo what Dr. Clark said. I say, tell your story every opportunity you get. I think the fewer surprises there are, the better your relationships will weather, you know, these rough times. And so you need to tell your story. You need to be really honest and transparent about what's happening. You need to engage your administrators. You need to engage your bargaining units. They need to be part of telling that story. I often, you know, feel like we have to remind them sometimes that, you know, we're going to give you the information, but you also have to be sure you go back and share it with your members, because they shouldn't be surprised either, because we are engaging and having these conversations with you. We're letting you know what's going on. And so tell your story, tell your story, tell your story. This is not going to go away. So we have to face it head on.
Right. And there's only one story, but it might just be tailor-made for the audience that you have. And so it's a lot easier if you've got one presentation and it's just a matter of just adding or deleting a couple of slides. But the story that you tell your board is the same story that you tell the unions, that you tell your parent teacher association, that you tell the local Rotary Club, or, you know, anybody else that you're in front of, because you want to make sure that message is consistent. So that's also great advice. Tony, we'll finish up with you, and then we'll start talking about, okay, if you had the ear of the legislature, what would your ask be?
Well, I think what Dr. Clark said and what Jennifer said is exactly it. You've got to make sure that everyone really does hear the story, hear the facts. And I think it starts with the principals. If your site leaders understand all of the information and they can present to their communities and give a consistent message to the entire population that you're serving, then you're going to have the best opportunity to weather this storm and have people come up with the creative solutions that are going to be necessary. So I think it is incumbent on that chief business official to really be connecting, growing, and feeding those principles that are right there at the front.
I love that, Tony, because you're right. That is the face that our parents are familiar with, that our parents trust. They don't know us that are sitting in the district office, right? So absolutely, that trust is going to come from that school site leadership. And so making sure that they're armed with the information that they need to share that is great information. Okay, so let's pretend that we had the attention of the governor and the legislature. So what would be your ask of them in order to help districts from falling over a fiscal cliff? I'm going to start with Candy because she kind of alluded to that already, but is there any other ask or anything else that you want to share in relation to that?
Or maybe how you would frame that legislation?
You know, I think that one of the things we really need to work on is educating our legislators about what is actually happening on the ground, right? I mean, they're doing the best that they can do with the information that they have. But sometimes, you know, they don't necessarily know, well, the whole harmless provision went away. They don't may not necessarily translate that to, well, because that happened and declining enrollment is happening, we're losing $10 million, right? I think that there definitely should be a statewide effort with all of our partners, be that CASBO or AXA or CSBA, to come together to make sure our legislatures really understand what the problem is, right? We're not saying give us more money. We're saying, because our enrollment is so volatile, it is hard for us to figure out where we're going to land, right? And also, as well as our ADA, it's still the same type of volatility that's happening. And so if the intent is to really stabilize our educational systems, then it's going to take some type of mechanism at the state level to systematically across the state create some type of stabilization plan for what we have right now. So I think that part is really important. I also wonder if there are ways to potentially extend out the amount of time that our LEAs have to spend some of the one-time dollars. I mean, I'm appreciative for the timeframe that we have, but as we've said on this call, trying to go from zero to 100 in 3 months, you know, it has been very difficult and in some cases next to impossible because of staffing shortages. And so what that means to me is there's going to be a very likelihood that some LEAs may not be able to spend all of that money, not for a lack of trying, but less just because of staffing issues. And so I think that now may be the time to also plant the seed at the legislative level that if there are state dollars that were one time in nature, perhaps we need to figure out how to extend some of those timelines to expend those dollars. Those are probably like the two biggest things that I have on my mind in terms of what I would want to share with legislators, because across our county, you know, we're seeing it. There are some districts that are spending the money, but I don't have situations where, you know, within you know, a short period of time, districts went from, again, zero to 100 and were able to build out robust programs. And so it takes about a year to plan, right? And so if it takes about a year to plan, if you've given someone $300 million in 1 year and expect them to build out a robust program, I think that's it's appreciative that the money came, but I think it's a bit unrealistic to expect that to happen in such a short period of time. And I wonder how many of these conversations should also happen at the federal level as well.
Yeah. And I think when you talk about, you know, the plans and us not having much time to really truly develop a comprehensive, well thought out plan, it's almost like we're you can't help but be reactive in that planning device. And really we're going back to plan B. We can't do what we thought we were going to do because we can't get the staffing. So what do we do now? Because the reality is we don't know when the staffing shortage is going to go away either. So I appreciate your thoughts because it definitely is something that's on everyone's mind around the state, I'm sure. Jennifer, what about you? If you had the ear of the governor and the legislature, what would be your pitch to them?
Well, I agree with Dr. Clark. A hold harmless would be ideal. But I do think there are some districts that were already in declining enrollment that maybe we're kicking the can down the road and weren't addressing it. So I can see the hesitation maybe coming from the legislature to maintain the hold harmless moving forward. But I do feel like we have to have some solution. I feel like it's not fair to our students that, you know, this is the environment we're in and they have a lot of needs right now. Our students are struggling with what has happened during this pandemic. That it's not normal. We've had students start school that still, they don't know what a normal school year is. And I think this is a wrong time to force districts into having conversations about eliminating services, about reducing staff. And so I think, you know, there are a lot of smart folks in that legislature. There are a lot of smart folks in education that have solutions. I'm really looking forward to hearing what Tony has to say because he already mentioned that he's got quite a few ideas. I love the idea of giving us longer to spend the one-time funds. I think that's smart. I mean, why would we want to force districts to spend money in a manner that really isn't hitting our target and our goals? So if we could get that, that would be an amazing ask and an amazing thing to receive. So I love that Dr. Clark came up with that idea. And really, I want to hear now what Tony has to say.
Tony, go ahead.
Well, I'm a pragmatic guy, and I agree with Dr. Clark on the timelines. And I kind of go back to 16, 17, 17, 18, 18, 19. As local control funding formula came on board and really started to ramp up, look at what we were starting to do in education. We were really starting to build programs. We were starting to make a difference. 1920 kind of got a little derailed. COVID took us left or right. But the thought behind local control funding formula was that if the legislature gives the guidance and the expectations of what we want to see achieved and give us the ability to find our pathways with our each local district, working directly with our county office of eds, having them be our partner and our leader, there that works. So taking a pragmatic approach, one of the things that's always been wrong with education is funding by ADA. I'm going to use a simple pragmatic example. If you have a 10,000 student district, and you have a 95% attendance rate. That's a fairly common set of metrics. That means you're getting funded for 9,500 students. You still have to buy 10,000 Chromebooks. You still have to buy 10,000 textbooks of each subject area. You still have to staff for 10,000 students. So we're already starting at a deficit. If we were to make a single change right now, a year where we know we're in test one, we know that the LAO has already come out, the DOF has already come out, that we're between 5 and maybe 10, maybe even more billion above what the projection is. We hit the GAN limit this year. The state has funds this year that are to be dedicated to education. We also know that the demographic trends with birth rates show that we're going to be in decline across the state for the next decade, all the way to 2030. So you can't just keep saying hold harmless to the old enrollment and kick the can. That doesn't work. But if we made a shift right now to enrollment-based funding, using that example of that 10,000 student district that was at 95%, they were getting funded at 9,500. If they've lost 6% of their students, they're now at 9,400. You fund them at 9,400 students next year. That is starting to change the funding mechanism to make it appropriate. It's allowing for districts not to have that cliff hit because of the ADA factor, where this year because of quarantine and because independent study laws were not what families wanted. They wanted what they had in some cases with virtual distance learning that we weren't able to do under the piece. That's the first step. Now we know that attendance matters for achievement. So the second thing we need to add in is just like supplemental and concentration grants, there needs to be an ADA grant. And we can pick a number there. My feeling is that depending on the district, some of the districts that get really harmed by local control funding formula are your almost basic aid districts, your ones that cross back and forth. I'll use a district in Contra Costa County. They have 9% unduplicated count. They're going to have almost the same reduction in overall funding as a district like West Contra Costa that had a 70% unduplicated count. But they had an average daily attendance of 97%. It's down at 93 now or 92 because of the pandemic. So what if you added at 90%, everyone gets funded for enrollment with a 90% ADA. For every percent your ADA is above, you get an additional 2% of the base grant. That district that is at 97% that isn't getting any supplemental or concentration grant now could be getting 14% on top of their base grant to make a difference. A district that already gets supplemental and concentration grant, they get back to 95. That is an equity lever. It continues to create a pathway. This wouldn't cost the state a dollar. They could do it probably and still have a fairly significant COLA added on top, and it would rebench the entire state right from the beginning. So I would advocate that we think smartly like we did with local control funding formula. I would advocate that we give more time for the one-time funds because it does take 1 or 2 years to fund them. But the third thing I would say is, please, don't create new categorical programs. This is not the time to direct what we're going to do. Allow our local districts to make decisions and strengthen the oversight and support that county offices have. I think Dr. Clark needs more fiscal experts. I believe every county office should have a CBO on loan or two that they can send to wherever school districts all of a sudden have a vacancy because interims are an issue. And honestly, that's the next job I want to find, is a way to work for a county and do that support, because I think counties need to have more funding and provide more direct support because they're on the ground and they can work with their individual districts. So it's really three things.
Tony, I can always count on you for thinking way outside of the box.
I like Tony's idea of rethinking how we're funded. And I mean, little fact here, when it comes to average daily attendance, there are about 5 or 6 states in the nation that fund their schools based off of ADA. Usually there's something else, either a single count day, a multiple count day, you know, or a single count period, but we're in the minority when it comes to utilizing average daily attendance for funding, if you look nationwide.
And I like the idea of not adding more categoricals. If I had my ask, and I'm already framing my messages to speak with our local legislators to say, if you want to help districts, take all of those dollars that we've put towards them this year and just roll that funding into the base, because that improves the situation for every district across the state. Base funding is to provide a core program. And as Jennifer pointed out earlier, everything that we've added in the last year, there's going to be an appetite to sustain going forward. And so one way to do that and make sure that we are impacting all students across the state is to put that into the base. I'm going to end this by asking our listeners to contact your legislator. Let them know that you're concerned that the end of the local control funding formula, Hold Harmless, will cause a dramatic drop in the funding for your school district, and ask that the state budget protect schools and prevent layoffs. So with that, that's your message, and look towards CASBO to help you with those talking points. And you can also look at the CASBO webpage in order to find out who your legislator is and find how to contact them. And you can also track legislation on the way there. And then finally, I'm going to say, Tina, because you get to blame me for all of the problems at your current district because you followed me. Every time you mention that, I'm going to have to say that I followed you in CASBO, and let's see what mess you leave me.
Yes, Eric was approved by the CASBO board last weekend to be the new vice president of CASBO at the start. His term will begin after the annual conference next year. So congratulations to Eric.
Thank you. And just don't mess it up for me, would you, Tina? So I want to say thank you to all of our guests. Appreciate your time here. You had some wonderful advice and some great opinions on where we need to go to protect school districts in the state. So thank you for your time and good luck out there.
If you have any feedback, you can follow CASBO on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. With everything going on, you don't want to miss an episode.
CASBO Connect, the voice of school business, is a production of CASBO, the California Association of School Business Officials. Smart business, smart schools.